Welcome to CSIS on this nice, bright, cool day. But we have a warm session for you this morning. Like this. Can you hear me if I step back? Okay, good. I'm happy to have the responsibility of introducing an old friend of mine, Ambassador Walther, whom I met in December of 2003, I think for the second time, when he was just setting up shop in Riyadh. Tony Cordesman had led a group from CSIS to Saudi Arabia and very kindly asked me to go along, and we had an opportunity to call upon the ambassador. He was just, I think you had space in a hotel at that time. Now he has a big, beautiful new building in Riyadh that pays a tremendous rent of one riyal a year. We have a lot of people in the room today, and we will have a Q&A session, and what the ambassador has to say will go up on our website. So let me take a minute or two to give you a feeling of this gentleman on my left. He took charge of the International Energy Forum in December of 2003. He previously served as Norway's ambassador to Austria. He had time in the UN offices and the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. He was Director General for Trade and Policy, Mineral, Natural Resources and the Environment in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Norway. He was ambassador to India. So he's had a very broad but very wide experience. He has been chairman of the IEA board. A lot of us are familiar with the IEA in Paris. And he was special advisor on international affairs to the Prime Minister of Norway and political advisor to the Minister of Petroleum and Energy of Norway. So here's a gentleman that has seen the issues from both sides, from the political side and the working side, so to speak. I got it. Anyway, I hope the microphone up on the podium is better than this one. So we're running a little late, so why don't we just get started? Lulu will run the presentation. Lulu is an old friend of ours from the Department of Energy who moved to Riyadh. Now it's gone. And last year, Lulu, you moved to Riyadh last year? Okay. So, without further ado, I'd like to introduce to you Ambassador Walther.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure being here. You mentioned that I'm Norwegian, and I think there are a few things you should know about Norwegians as a point of departure for my presentation today. A lot you must know already. The president of the CSIS is Norwegian. And to illustrate what a Norwegian is and how you can use him, I will use one of my fingers, this finger, a language understood by both producers and consumers of energy. Firstly, the Norwegians are a seafaring people. They always have a finger in the air. Because it's important for sailors and fishermen to know which way the wind is blowing. Today, as when our Vikings crossed the Atlantic half a millennium before Columbus and discovered people here who later became known as Americans. And in contrast to Columbus, he knew he was not on the east coast of India. Secondly, Norwegians are farmers. They have their feet solidly planted on the ground, their fingers in the soil, never forgetting where they come from, where they are, and where they're going. You have some of them here in the U.S., especially in the Midwest. Hubert Humphrey, Walter Mondale, they almost made it to the top. Thirdly, Norwegians are a very egalitarian bunch, and we've had our imperialist fun 1,000 years ago. Today we are quite peace-loving. and we are especially fond of facilitating peace abroad. The Norwegians also have the honor of awarding the prestigious Nobel Peace Prize. Now, this year to Al Gore. And this is a pleasure magnified by the fact that we do it with Swedish money. Yeah. With this moralistic missionary streak, we are always pointing our finger at others, telling them what they should do and what they should not do. And Norwegians truly believe that the world can become a better place. And also they truly believe that they are the chosen people to spearhead that development. I'm saying this from a point of total objectivity because I was born in Brooklyn. And I don't have to tell you anything about Brooklyn. But I left Brooklyn before I was old enough to join a street gang. Later, I joined the Norwegian Foreign Service. Some people say that's more or less the same thing. So that having been said, energy and environment is really center beam in the international political spotlight of our day. And energy security continues to top the political agenda for oil and energy importing countries, for exporting countries, for industrialized as well as developing countries. And we are all addicted to energy because each and every country needs energy to reach its economic and social objectives. Energy also affects commercial relations between countries, and it fuels the world economy. It impacts the environment. And energy influences and is influenced by international politics. It is a real challenge for the industry that is set to harness it, and also a challenge for the national and international leadership that would govern it. It goes to the very core of political, economic, and environmental interests of individual countries and to the global community. And it is difficult to imagine an area where nations are more interdependent than in the confluence of energy, environment, and economic development. Preparations are now well underway for the 11th International Energy Forum Ministerial that Italy will host in Rome in April, assisted by the IF Secretariat. This forthcoming Rome Ministerial offers a new global opportunity to address our current energy concerns. The increasing awareness of shared vulnerabilities, common interests, developed through the producer-consumer dialogue, gives a stimulus to frank discussion also of issues where we do not have a consensus agreement today, where new understandings can be reached, and also where concerted policy action can contribute to our common global energy security. So I'm honored, very honored, to have this opportunity today to highlight, against the backdrop of the current global heightened energy consciousness, the importance of a deepened dialogue when we are addressing energy uncertainties, and also the importance of synchronized efforts for national and global energy security. I will recall the background, the emergence, the development of the International Energy Forum, the political level dialogue in that forum, how the IEF has contributed to bringing producer-consumer relations out of an era of confrontation, and also say a few words on why I believe it will continue as an important venue for converging outlooks towards equitable and win-win cooperation for global energy security. Looking ahead, producer-consumer dialogue, international energy relations will develop against a very complex backdrop. Just to mention some key elements, that fossil fuels will remain paramount for quite some time. Increasing attention will be paid to the development of alternatives we will have increasing energy demand and also increasing energy efficiency, increasing energy trade due to the geographical mismatch between the centers of oil and gas production and consumption. There will be increasing competition for energy resources and among energy resources. We will see a new set of relationships develop between national oil companies and the international oil companies. We will see resource nationalism, governments wanting to make the most of their national endowment. Some countries will choose policies of energy independence, others energy interdependence, for their energy security. We have a growing environmental and climate change concern, not least in public opinion. There will be an increasing need for environmentally benign and cost-efficient new technology. We will see increasing vulnerability of energy production and supply to politically motivated disruption, terrorist attack, technical mishap, and forces of nature. We have a call for good governance and transparency, people expecting their governments to provide sufficient, reliable, and affordable energy. And not to forget energy poverty. The demands for equitable access to energy for the quarter of the world's population who do not have it today, but who will want it for a better life tomorrow. We have the shift towards Asia of global economic activity. This has geopolitical and energy implications. With this international spotlight now on energy, questions are being asked, and they are difficult to answer. Are there energy resources enough? Will the investments needed to develop these resources be made in time? Will energy be accessible and affordable, not only for the privileged few? Will there be conflict and scramble for resources adversely affecting sustainable global developments? And what about the environment and climate change? Will we see new patterns of energy cooperation shaping new geopolitical realities? Or will established geopolitical realities be a break or prevent wise and sustainable energy solutions? With the energy and environmental uncertainties we see today, countries and groups of countries are rethinking fundamental policies. Diversity is widely seen as key to policies for energy security. Diversity of suppliers and in the energy mix for the consumers, diversity of markets for the producers. But the policy tuning of one country to meet new challenges, to address their particular uncertainties, that can also exacerbate uncertainties and create new ones for others. Amid the uncertainties, there is a fundamental certainty. The world will need more and cleaner energy, used in a more efficient way, accessible and affordable to a larger share of the world's population. The political challenge lies in operationalizing this energy imperative in a fair and sustainable way, through national policies as well as in bilateral, regional, and global cooperation. The global producer-consumer dialogue in the IEF acquires increasing importance as nations revisit and modify their established policies and shape new ones in their quest for energy security. The dialogue in the IEF transcends the traditional political, economic, and energy policy dividing lines. It gathers under one global political umbrella ministers not only of the petroleum exporting countries of OPEC, the ministers of the industrialized energy importing countries of the OECD, but very importantly, it gathers ministers of countries outside these organizations, such as Russia, China, India, Brazil, South Africa, and many others, that will have increasing impact on the global scenario. Producer-consumer dialogue has played its part in ushering international energy affairs out of an era of mistrust and confrontation into one of greater understanding, better awareness of long-term common interests, and a convergence of views and outlooks. The knowledge basis for national decision-making and more purposeful coordination of policies within other organizations is better than before, We can see results in concrete measures taken by both consumer and producer countries individually and by their organizations. And the results of dialogue are also evident in statements of policy intent that in times of geopolitical and other uncertainties send calming signals to nervous energy markets. I believe that the IF can increasingly serve as a global focal point for the wider global energy policy interrelationship of cooperative contacts that has to emerge among governments at political and officials level, on bilateral, regional, and global bases. Not only governments, but also the oil companies, financial institutions, international organizations, and the many other stakeholders have a role to play in a new and more comprehensive energy dialogue. The importance of energy dialogue and the role of the International Energy Forum as a cooperative mechanism is enjoying increasing international recognition by ministers individually and by regional and global energy organizations, not least by the G8 heads of government at their summits in Gleneagle in 2005 and in St. Petersburg last year under the presidency of Russia. At the very top of the St. Petersburg Plan of Action on Global Energy Security, the G8 heads of state and government underscored the importance of the dialogue and invited the IF to study ways of broadening the dialogue between producing and consuming countries, on increasing transparency, predictability, and stability of global energy markets. And this includes information exchange on medium and long-term policy plans and programs. The IF has now, after a few years, found its place in the family of international energy organizations. Yet for many years, it was politically simply not on for energy ministers of consuming and producing countries to meet in a multilateral context. The strategic commodity oil and market volatility could create conflict or exacerbate political tensions between countries and groups of countries. The oil crisis of 1973-74 in the wake of Middle East war, the use of oil as a political weapon, had pitted petroleum-producing and consuming countries antagonistically against each other. OPEC and the IEA emerged as the bipolar and multilateral expression of conflicting producer and consumer interests. Cooperative relations could develop on a bilateral basis between oil and producing and consuming countries. But multilateral approaches to build bridges and establish a structured producer-consumer relationship, foundered first in the Conference on International Economic Cooperation in Paris and again in UNCTAD in the second half of the 70s. But it became increasingly clear that sharply fluctuating oil prices were detrimental to both producers and consumers, and that there could be no long-term winners in troubled energy markets. Less volatility in the market, stable prices at a reasonable level for both producers and consumers, emerged as a shared ambition and a new cooperative mantra. The World Commission on Environment and Development acknowledged in its report, Our Common Future, in 1987, the importance of energy for sustainable economic and social development. And it recommended that new mechanisms for encouraging dialogue between consumers and producers be explored. On that note, the chairperson of the Commission, and then Prime Minister of Norway, called for an informal workshop of energy producing and consuming countries at ministerial level to discuss the resource and market situation and outlook, as well as the links between energy and environment. Many countries were ready to try, but some important industrialized countries regarded the very idea of dialogue on these matters at political level as a non-starter, even as outright dangerous, if not also illegal. Some seem to regard the differences and conflicts between producers and consumers as permanent facts of life. a divide that no political level dialogue could bridge or should even attempt to bridge. One just had to live with sharply fluctuating prices, instability, and mutual insecurity. The Gulf War in 1990-91 highlighted again the geopolitical and economic importance of oil. A more cooperative atmosphere between producers and consumers ensued in its wake. Presidents Mitterrand of France and Pérez of Venezuela convened a ministerial seminar of producers and consumers in Paris in 1991, and this broke the political ice. It was followed by an informal ministerial workshop in Norway the following year that broadened the dialogue from the traditional bipolar IEA-OPEC configuration to focus also on the energy powerhouse Russia. Both ministers of foreign affairs and energy ministers took part. And this highlighted also the wider economic and foreign policy geopolitical importance of energy developments. The process of IEF ministerials then moved on to Spain in 1994. It crossed the Atlantic to Venezuela in 1995. Before moving outside OPEC and IEA territorial domain to India in 1996, acknowledging also the importance of Asia and Asia's growing energy needs as a very important dimension of the global energy policy interrelationship. Ministerials followed in South Africa and Riyadh, where King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, then Crown Prince, proposed the establishment of a permanent secretariat and offered to host it in Riyadh. The following ministerial in Japan endorsed the establishment of the secretariat, and the secretariat presented itself at the 9th IEF in the Netherlands in 2004, where also a new dimension was brought to the ministerial dialogue. The first International Energy Business Forum was convened, bringing ministers and CEOs of leading international and national oil companies together in informal talks before the ministers had their internal meetings. Qatar hosted the 10th ministerial last year, and their ministers coined energy security as a shared responsibility, highlighting both sides of the energy security coin: security of demand for the energy exporting countries, security of supply for the energy importing countries. Ministers noted then that world economic growth had remained strong despite increasing oil prices and market volatility, but expressed concern over the effects of sustained high oil prices on the world economy, especially for the developing countries. They reconfirmed their shared interest in reduced market volatility and prices at reasonable levels. They attributed the higher oil prices to a number of factors, including the increasing demand, tight up and downstream capacities, the intervention of non-industrial actors, and the geopolitical developments, all of which contributed to increased anxiety in the market. They called for a stepping up of investments across the energy chain to meet the substantial increase in demand required for global economic growth and social development in the years ahead. They urged accelerated development of cleaner fossil fuel technologies, along with alternative sources of energy, and increased energy efficiency in a world that would continue to rely strongly on its ample supplies of fossil fuels, oil, natural gas, and coal. They underscored also that improved access to markets, technology, and financial services, bolstered by fair and transparent economic, fiscal, and legal regulatory frameworks, and by good governance, are crucial for the long-term energy security of both producers and consumers. And they also acknowledged the need to do something about the shortage of skilled labor throughout the industry. The IEF has developed from an informal ministerial seminar to become the largest recurring global gathering of energy ministers. Unique not only in its global perspective and scope, but also in its approach. It is not a decision-making organization or a forum for negotiation of legally binding settlements or agreeing on any collective action. It's not a body for a multilateral fixing of prices and production levels. It is a forum for talk. And in addition to frank, informal plenary sessions, the ministerials have increasingly become an important venue for bilateral meetings among ministers, time efficiently, and also between ministers and CEOs of companies. The mission of the Secretariat is to enhance and provide continuity to this political level dialogue, and we focus on three pillars of activity. The first and the core pillar is to support the host country in preparing, implementing, and following up the biennial ministerials. The second, to facilitate and enhance the exchange of energy data and information, especially by coordinating the joint oil data initiative. The third pillar is to provide additional platforms for exchange of views on relevant energy issues in support of a deepening of the ministerial level dialogue. The joint oil data initiative is a concrete outcome of the producer-consumer dialogue. And coordination of this international transparency initiative is a flagship activity for the Secretariat. With the active participation and full support of our partner organizations, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation APEC, the European Communities, the IEA, the Latin American Organization for Energy Cooperation, OPEC, and the UN. These partner organizations joined hands to set up something called the Joint Oil Data Exercise in 2001, following a call by ministers to do something about the lack of transparency that was seen to cause excessive price fluctuations. They established the Joint Oil Data Initiative as a permanent mechanism in 2003. And following the endorsement of IF ministers, the IF Secretariat assumed the coordination of JODI in 2005, and we managed the JODI World Database with the objective of improving the quality and transparency of international oil statistics. Now, about 95 countries, representing about 95% of global supply and demand of oil, are submitting data to JODI through their partner organizations. The data cover production, demand, stock levels of seven product categories, the most important of which is crude oil. They underline in the IF the importance of transparency and exchange of data for market predictability and for the investments required to enhance energy security. And the ministers envisage also that this oil data initiative be expanded to include also other sources of energy that are important in the world energy mix. We will present to our next ministerial meeting a feasibility study on the potential expansion of JODI to include natural gas. The importance of better data through JODI for energy security was forcefully echoed by the G8 heads of government in St. Petersburg. And they pledged to take further action to improve and enhance the collection and reporting of market data on oil, including through development of a global standard for reporting reserves. The G8 invited the IF to work on the expansion of JODI membership, which we are doing, and also to continue to improve the quality and timeliness of data, which is an ongoing process. JODI is international ambition translated into action. For its success, we rely on the political support of participating countries and the submission of their timely and accurate data. While energy security is the core objective of the political level dialogue in the IF, it is because it goes, as I mentioned earlier, to the core of national interests. And it is also, as we see today, an increasingly global issue in an increasingly interdependent world and an energy world that is becoming increasingly multipolar. The deliberations in the IF have shown how truly multidimensional the challenge of global energy security is. There is no quick and lasting fix. For nations to talk about energy security at political level, bilaterally, regionally, and globally, is good. But actually doing something about it is better. And that requires dialogue and partnerships, also among governments and industry. Some are arguing that dependency on others in so important and strategic an area as energy constitutes a political and economic risk that should be reduced to a minimum if it cannot be avoided altogether. Others argue that energy dependency is not only practical and inevitable, but it is also something that could tie countries closer together economically and then also have a positive political spillover effect. Energy interdependence can be good, but it can also be bad. And for it to be good and sustainable, it has to be mutually beneficial. Highlighting the two sides of the energy security coin, some of our ministers are now requesting a roadmap from the energy exporting countries on future supply. And the ministers of these energy exporting countries are likewise requesting a roadmap on future energy demand from the energy importing countries. Also, with regard to energy security, I would like to underline how it is becoming more and more an issue that is not just a matter of technical arrangements and infrastructure. It has to do with economics, geopolitics, and the environment. It has domestic and foreign policy implications. The quest for sustainable global energy security is being highlighted not only by the energy ministers. Heads of government, ministers of foreign affairs, finance ministers, minister of economic affairs, trade, environment, development, and what have you, are adding their voices as well, as are non-governmental organizations and other stakeholders. More and more people are joining the energy dialogue, and often for very different reasons. And core to all this is an energy industry itself, doing the actual work, finding, producing, and bringing much-needed energy to the consumer. Energy security in its wider, more holistic, global and long-term perspective was the focus theme of the UN Commission on Sustainable Development last year and this year, underscoring the importance of energy for our efforts to meet the Millennium Development Goals. We had the opportunity to bring IEF perspectives to the Commission's concluding ministerial session in May this year, where the efforts of ministers to finalize a consensus document failed, testifying to the political, economic, and environmental complexity of these energy issues. As global focus now is being put on these issues of energy security, regional and interregional energy cooperation is also being strengthened in this increasingly multipolar energy world. Parallel processes of global and regional cooperation can strengthen energy security, and regional and interregional cooperation can provide stepping stones to global approaches and cooperation. These should not go off in different, globally disruptive, and conflicting directions. The biennial IEF ministerials acquire, in that perspective, increased importance as a global meeting point for this mosaic of regional and interregional energy ambition. I would especially like to highlight what is taking place in the wider Asia today, where energy cooperation is taking new form, recognizing the global impact of developments in Asia. We are facilitating a process of roundtables of energy, Asian energy ministers, that was initiated by India in 2005. This gathers the ministers of the principal Asian importers and the West Asian Gulf producers, and also North Asian, that is Russia, and Central Asian producers. Countries representing more than half of the world's population, the bulk of the world's remaining proven oil and gas reserves, and very importantly, the greater part of the surging global energy demand expected in the years ahead. They are now interacting on a broad Asian basis for the first time, addressing stability, sustainability, and security of energy. Saudi Arabia hosted the second roundtable in May this year, and this process will continue with a third roundtable in Japan in 2009 under the IF global umbrella. It's already been decided that Kuwait will host the fourth Asian ministerial roundtable and Korea will host the fifth. So this is a process that has started, it's deepening, and we'll see it continue. They recognize very importantly in this process that the Asian oil economy is integral to and inseparable from the global oil economy. But they are calling for greater coordination among Asian energy exporters and importers, and underscoring not least the need for cross-national investments. And we see their Asian perspectives being brought increasingly to bear in the global dialogue. The 11th IF ministerial in April will offer a new opportunity to address many of these energy resource challenges. The ministers will update their outlooks with regard to supply and demand, as well as market conditions, and also with a view to finding ways to remove bottlenecks and to enhance market stability. They will, of course, again discuss how to promote these substantial energy investments where and when needed. They will also identify policies towards more sustainable energy future, addressing climate change, environmental concern, the access to energy for developing countries, and not least the importance of developing cleaner fossil fuel technologies. If all roads lead to Rome, the road of energy dialogue does not end there, and it continues beyond. Neither energy nor dialogue are goals in themselves, but means to promote economic and social development, and that in a way that also strengthens relations among countries. The dialogue in the IEF is a confidence-building process, above all. It's a dialogue where ministers can focus on energy security, addressing the links between energy, environment, and economic development, in a way that promotes their national interests in the wider context of promoting also global objectives. And in that perspective, there is no final destination for this dialogue in an evolving energy world. And it is ultimately the ambition of the participating countries and the sum of their policy measures that will determine its achievements and success. Given the strategic importance of energy to each and every country, I do not see the establishment in any near future of a global energy organization where national decision-making would be relinquished and replaced by binding global energy governance. But through the myriad of established and future partnerships between governments and industry, I do see the producer-consumer dialogue in the IEF as a vehicle to develop a global code of energy conduct, a code of conduct that would be advantageous for all to follow and from which to deviate in pursuit of short-term advantages at the expense of others would be tantamount to shooting oneself in the foot, at the very least. Thank you.
I'm now going to open the floor for questions and answers, but first let me ask that we have microphones around the room. When the microphone comes to you, please identify yourself, and please try to abstain from making statements. Just give us a question, and we'll do our best to answer. And I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair to ask the first question, and it has to do with the Joint All Data Initiative. A couple of years ago at CSIS, we tried to put together a project on oil producing capacities, particularly in the Persian Gulf. It's a great idea. First country we approached for funding said, "Oh, that's a great idea. Where can I sign?" And we said, "Well, you know, right here." So, but you know, I'm really interested in what these other people have, but of course, I can't tell you what we've got because it's a state secret. Well, if you go to each of the countries, you get the same problem. Yes, we'd like to know what everybody else has, but ours, we can't make it available. So, you know, I just wonder how successful this initiative is going to be in coming up with the kinds of data that we really need. Could I put the question to you now?
Yes. Well, first of all, when we were given the task of coordinating JODI, a lot of people thought that we would be sort of an agency to verify the statistics of the IA, of OPEC, and so forth, putting a stamp on it. This is real life. And that also we would have the muscle, the teeth, to gather statistics from governments. Collecting data from governments is the responsibility of our partner organizations. They submit their data to us. They do the quality assurance. And we collate this and then put this into the JODI World Database. This is, in a way, work in process. Some people wanted or were skeptical to this and wanted to see it fully developed as a perfect mechanism before going public. We took the opposite approach, that probably you'll never have a perfect system. But we have to start somewhere. And then if there are problems, if people see deficiencies and so forth, please tell us so we can improve it. And with that more humble approach, we have also developed a scorecard where we have three faces: a smiley face, a grumpy face, and a neutral face. And these faces indicate the satisfaction of the JODI partners with regard to the submission, timeliness, and completeness of data from individual countries. We should have had perhaps a slide on that. Now, this is a way of embarrassing countries in a nice political way to provide better data. And it works. When we have a ministerial meeting, we have this chart big so that all can see. The ministers run up to it to find their own country. When they see that there are grumpy faces there, they wonder why, because this is embarrassing. So they tell their people, I want to see, if not a smiley face, a neutral face next time. Statistics, you can say a lot about statistics, and a lot has been said. We have, of course, some statistics that are regarded as state secrets. We have to respect that. Some countries, they determine what their state secrets are and what their interests are. But I think that by doing something and being optimistic, a ball has started to roll. Transparency is important. It is being increasingly recognized as important. And having more information for all players would logically lead to better decisions. How to break, let's say, a barrier of countries not being able or not wanting to give statistics. We have to remember also that in very many countries, especially developing countries, they don't have statistics and don't know how to collect them. We have a lot of interest in this exercise from the oil companies. They have their own ways of finding statistics, or counting ships, or whatever they do, and find JODI useful also to check their own information. So JODI is spearheading something. It's not the whole picture. Ministers are happy with it and would like to see it strengthened, and now especially with regard to natural gas.
Thank you. Okay, the floor is open for questions. Back here.
Oh, sorry. Good morning. A point of personal reference, I was also born in Brooklyn. Oh. And I must say, you don't see many diplomats coming out of Brooklyn. So,
but could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, Gerald Carey with Platts. You mentioned JODI as a concrete example of a concrete work product. Is there anything else in the offing that that you're expecting? And secondly, you also mentioned the oil crisis of the 1980s. If a similar circumstance, how would your organization function?
Well, first of all, with regard to Brooklyn and diplomats, I realize that most people, or very many people, choose American show business. And I chose Norwegian diplomacy. It's more or less the same thing. Let's see, could I just have the latter part of your question first? I wanted to start with that. I forgot it in thinking too much about Brooklyn.
Sorry. You mentioned the oil crisis of the 1980s.
Yeah.
In a similar circumstance, or anything you want, a scenario you want to hypothesize, how would the organization function to try to mitigate that, to head that off?
Well, the organization functions in the sense that the ministers involved, the ministers of influence, function. Not many years ago, ministers of producing and consuming countries could not meet. Having a meeting between producers and consumers would be seen as very dramatic. People would expect something to come out of it. Now, through this dialogue, where ministers, even of countries that don't recognize each other, sit around a table and discuss, they have become friends. They can pick up a telephone. And this is increasingly being done. We had, for example, the situation leading up to the Iraq war. For a long time, people expected that something would happen. Then it did happen, and it's still happening. But without any communication, the psychological situation for the oil market would have been much worse. We have OPEC and the IEA talking to the public. OPEC saying that if there are any disruptions, we will replace whatever falls out with spare capacity. The IEA welcomes that in official statement, saying that this is the right thing to do, and if you cannot do enough, we will do something too. We can release from our stocks. We can introduce energy efficiency measures. Now, saying this in a situation before something happens sends calming signals to the market. And this, I think, is one of the important functions of the organization. We are not sitting there telling OPEC what to say, or telling the IEA what to say, or saying anything ourselves. But through this dialogue, the ministers who have influence, who can impact developments, they consult each other and they act.
Question over here.
Bill Veal, I'm executive director of the U.S.-Kazakhstan Business Association. I'm also a Norwegian-American, I should add here. my question is, in your dialogue, are you including questions of investment climate, recognizing what you said at the end about the role of industry?
Yeah. No, the issue of investments really came on the top of the agenda in 2004 when we had our ministerial in Amsterdam. And that was also on the basis of an IEA study, or the World Energy Outlook, that year focused on the importance of investments. And that, looking at the enormous increase in demand that we see ahead, the need to replace and build new infrastructure, the money is there. I mean, the money is always there if a project is good. And the issue is, how do we get these investments made? These investments have to come from private industry. And the figure, I think, was some $17 trillion U.S. dollars by 2030. I think that has increased even a little more since then. What they discuss is also what you see in the press, that companies that have money to invest are looking for a long-term investment. They're looking for predictability. They're looking for legal frameworks that they can understand and that will actually be implemented. All these issues are being looked at, and also when countries behave in a way that would discourage such investments, that is also put on the table. Also on the other side, there are some producing countries who say that, well, also the consuming countries have are at some fault with regard to investments, because there has been investment bans in some oil-producing countries, where the oil industry now, due to lack of investment over a long period of time, is outdated. So these are things where you have a lot of political considerations, but everyone is basically seeing the need to invest, and when everyone has, let's say, gets something out of it, then I'm confident that these investments will come. But this is not something that, again, our organization can do. We can't implement anything. We are providing a forum for people to talk calmly together without having what they say on the front page of important newspapers the next day. Could I just ask how many people of Norwegian descent are in the audience? Please raise your right hand. Svetta, yes. Okay. And could I also just say that I would very much appreciate comments, and also to learn something from you, to take back to our ministerial level dialogue. I mean, here we have a lot of people with experience from very many parts of oil industry, and I would be quite happy if you even give us advice. Thank you.
Mark.
Thank you, Ambassador Walter. Mark Finley with BP. I'm interested to hear your perspective on these roadmaps for future energy supply and demand. I mean, given the many efforts that are underway to forecast energy supply and demand, and frankly the checkered history of some of these efforts in the past, what's the value added from the IEF coordinating this? What's to be done and what's to be gained?
Well, we are not, let's say, coordinating or making any roadmap. And the word roadmap is one of the political words of our day. And we all know that roadmaps are very difficult to make. Also, once made, they are very difficult to follow. But the idea of a roadmap is more or less indicating in some broad way where you intend to go, and also what you can do, provided others also do something to encourage that. There are oil-producing countries that would be happy to invest more in production capacity if they are assured of markets in a long-term perspective. If they are not assured of markets, then it makes little point in developing or investing in huge capacity increases. So it's this type of roadmap that is important. We also see how countries are, and this also affects the traditional oil producers, that in the industrialized countries, people are increasingly talking about the negative aspects of oil, looking for environmentally more friendly energy resources. This creates also an uncertainty in those countries that you are asking to produce more to lower oil prices. So this roadmap, I don't see, a roadmap presented that everyone will strictly follow, but this is more an indicative way where things are going, where you want them to go, and and how you can try to influence others to help you on that road.
Question back here.
Claire Williams, Department of State. I wanted to ask you, there were two points about your ministerial history, the IEF's ministerial history, and then you were forecasting about the absence of a global energy decision-making body. But through the history of the ministerials, you've actually seen an increase in the number of countries, an increase in the number of voices, the fall of the Soviet Union, the fall of Yugoslavia. And I wonder if you can comment on the regionalization of energy dialogue, if you're going to see regions within countries, and if you'll forgive the phrase, the balkanization of energy dialogue, if you see that as playing into IEF's future.
We've had this discussion in the IEF, and some people would say that, well, we're dealing with a global dialogue, so we should only deal with global issues. My perspective has been that if you are concerned about energy security and want to have results, the easiest thing to do is to act unilaterally. Then the next easiest is to do something bilaterally. A little more difficult to do something regionally. And the most difficult is to do something globally. And if you just concentrate on these, let's say, lofty global perspectives, you might find yourself in the clouds and with your feet not touching the ground. And as all Norwegians would know, as I mentioned, they are farmers too, with their feet solidly planted on the ground. And I think it's very, very important to interact with these regional processes. We attach great importance to being part of some of these, bringing our global perspectives to these regional exercises, but then also, again, taking from regional, cooperative efforts, what they are concerned about, to have that addressed in the global dialogue. So as I said, we see the IEF as a focal point, a meeting place for all these endeavors. I don't think this balkanization is anything one should feel badly or well about. I think it's something that will happen and is happening because it is natural from this perspective of unilateral, bilateral, and so forth. But what is important is that people are going in the right direction and that they don't go off in a balkanization that where people shoot each other in the foot and that we move away from where we want to go in the global sense. This, multipolar energy world, to put it like that, is also something we have to expect because the international energy policy has for very many years been an issue of some 20 IEA countries, 27 now, industrialized rich countries on the one hand and 11 OPEC countries on the other. And what they have talked about, whether they disagree or agree, that has been seen as the global energy dialogue. Today, we don't have that bipolar world anymore, with Russia, with China, with India. And there is, I think, something very fundamental happening now in the energy world with this, multipolar focus, and that this, given the importance of energy, also for economic relations, will have geopolitical impact. And it is something that is coming. And I think it is wise for people to have their eyes open and to see how this can be constructively used.
Question right in front here. Bob? Okay. Yeah, it's coming.
Bob Kopaken. I'm not Norwegian, but I see that we have something in common. I went to the London School of Economics as well.
Yeah.
And I am a veteran of SEEC, North-South Dialogue, and everything that came after it. My question is, we've not mentioned the word price. And yet we're in a market that is unprecedented in terms of level of price and acceleration of price. I realize that that's a critical element, and it's not really something that the Energy Forum can discuss in detail. But how do you get around that kind of an issue? Because clearly it's important not only to producers but also to consumers. And just a parenthetical question, how much of your budget is spent on travel?
Okay. To start with the latter, much less than other organizations. Also because we are very lean. And we have only, let's say, six professional staff that cannot be, you know, away from office, you know, too long. We are below, I think, a critical mass. So we don't have, you know, the opportunity to be everywhere. So we are only we are very choosy about what we do abroad. The price issue has long been one that made it impossible for some countries to participate in a dialogue, because that would be seen as interfering in the free play of market forces. Governments should not be in the price-fixing business. What we agree on is that the price should be reasonable. You can ask me what is reasonable, and I will say that we will know it when we see it. But I think I think it's if you want to put it in words, it would be a price that gives the countries that have oil motivation to produce oil. It shouldn't be so high that people waste it with the adverse environmental aspects, and it shouldn't be so high that it it impacts negatively on the world economy. And then, so if you were to press me on a figure, I would not be surprised if most people thought it would be in the range of, let's say, between 10 and something around where it is today, perhaps even higher. But further than that, I don't think I can go. No, I mean, what is reasonable? I mean, people, yeah, I mean, we watch the price, we see where it is, and yeah.
Take a question back here in the audience.
Sam Hancock with Green Motion, the Eurasia Center. It seems like you have a wealth of excellent information. We have a newsletter. It has about 300,000 distribution in 150 countries. Is there any way that we can link that information so we can send it out to our readers and also expand the information that's coming out of your organization? It sounds like an excellent way to get that. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you know. You notice I spoke on energy now for, I don't know, a little too long perhaps, but I didn't mention one figure. I didn't have any charts indicating where we would be when I'm dead. What I wanted to bring forth was considerations. I look at figures that people present. You look at figures, you know them. The information that comes out of the IEF is something that is basically internal, because we want to have a forum where ministers can meet to discuss frankly, address problems, you know, that are problems, and that cannot be solved by some, you know, quick decision. But these are things that have to be managed, and things that could be managed better if people, you know, do it in a confidence-building process. The information we have, we publish a newsletter. I think there will be some available here. We have the privilege of ministers writing articles for us, short-focused articles where they highlight the issues that they think are important to discuss in the dialogue. We don't have, we're not competing, we don't have the resources to compete with all the other established agencies, consultants, who have produced figures, analysis, and so forth. We are trying to create an environment where ministers can talk both freely and confidently together. So what we have from our meetings, because there is great interest from the press and so forth, we do not have any negotiated communiques or any agreed statements. But after each ministerial, the host country, and then supported by us, would make a summary on its own responsibility of what happened during the course of the meeting. That summary would have to be fair and indicate more or less the issues that were discussed. If there are some clear conclusions, fine. But this is not something that is subject to, let's say, preparatory negotiations among government officials, and the ministers meet, and you agree on something, and then you implement it. This is, we want to keep this agenda open so that when ministers meet, they can talk about what they're interested in there and then, that very day. We do not want to set a detailed agenda 6 months in advance, knowing that it might be irrelevant. This is getting around your question a little, and we have our website and so forth, and are quite happy that the ministers know who we are, that the ministers use us, they support us. We are funded not by, let's say, compulsory funds, as other organizations are. We are based on voluntary contributions from member countries. And the money is flowing in because the ministers find this, you know, a useful exercise. And as such, then, we are not, you know, selling a product to the world and have, let's say, an exposure which is more internal than external.
Thank you. I want to congratulate this audience. Not once have I heard a cell phone ring. Not once. Which is somewhat unusual, I have to say. I was reminded that a couple of years ago I was in Anchorage speaking at a conference, and the chairman announced at the very beginning, said, "You will notice on each table there's a blank envelope, but marked American Red Cross. If your telephone rings during the meeting, you are to take a $20 bill and put it in that envelope." Well, I came prepared today with a spare envelope marked Funds for the CSIS Energy Program. But I haven't, there's been no contribution. So, next question.
Now, as your guest, I would have quickly removed that envelope, putting one for the IFS, which is based on voluntary contributions from countries, companies, and also individuals.
Frank?
Breakthrough discussions on futures without setting targets on price or demand level.
One interesting dimension of that is that we have energy ministers having met over a number of years. They know each other's positions by heart. You can take one minister and put him in the seat of a consumer and the seat of a producer and vice versa. They will say, they know what to say. They won't necessarily agree. Today the dialogue has, let's say, brought about a convergence of thinking among energy ministers. But I think we will increasingly see that energy is not only about energy ministers, and that in some countries there's more need for dialogue in a cabinet where you have environmental interests, financial interests, political interests, and also a need for each country to speak with the same, you say, the same tongue in all international contexts. So very often I think we would see that within a country there are greater differences than between countries at the level of energy ministers in terms of how they assess the situation and also in, you know, what should be done to meet it. And that is why I also think that in the longer term we have to have, let's say, a new kind of dialogue which includes others than energy ministers as well. If you also look at the UN Commission on Sustainable Development, 2 years they focused on the importance of energy. But which ministers were there? Very few energy ministers. Development cooperation ministers, environment ministers, trying to establish an energy agenda. Now this is probably also why their efforts failed, because the energy ministers were not there. We have to have another type of dialogue where we just look at the fact that more or less that everything is connected with everything else. And you cannot isolate such an important thing as energy without looking at the consequences and trade-offs that you need.
Question in the back.
Yeah, hi, I'm Dan Witten with Bloomberg News. You mentioned that the statements by IEA and OPEC are having calming signals in the market. Today, the market's responding to lower U.S. supplies, dollar going down the toilet. Before that, it was Turkey invading Kurdistan. Yeah. What signals do you think the market's responding to right now? Do you think the signals are not calming, or why is the market going up like this? What are the signals telling the market?
Well, I think signals are very much dependent on who is also on the receiving end. And we have a lot of uncertainties. We have geopolitical uncertainties today, yesterday, and tomorrow. We have the non-industrial actors. We have the fundamentals. We have bottlenecks. We have Mother Nature. We have the fear of terrorist attack. We have also the fear of, let's say, political motivated disruption of supplies. There are a lot of things there in this equation, and we simply need to know more about the whole thing. And that is one of the purposes of the dialogue, to try to understand these things better. I have no answers. And and also, getting back, you said that dialogue was good for the sake of dialogue. I don't necessarily agree. I mean, dialogue has to produce something. But it is better that people talk than that they don't talk, especially in an area such as energy, where we've had these psychological disturbances, more or less, in the market. Whenever anyone is afraid of something happening, then people take measures to guard themselves, and that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in many ways. But you wanted a very specific thing, where I see prices going, or what signals.
No.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I don't know. I wake up every morning and...
there's always this sort of terrorism premium that people throw in there, that there's some premium based on these psychological disturbances. I guess you wouldn't comment on what that...
There are these geopolitical premiums, there are premiums, speculation premiums, all kinds of premiums. I have no way of knowing how much, let's say, uncertainties can be attributed to each and every factor. We know that there are many factors here that that cause the situation we are in. And I'm happy to listen to anyone who can put a premium, a figure, but I don't necessarily have to believe that. I don't know what, how people can put, let's say, a $15 premium on this or that in relation to fundamentals.
We have time for one more question, right here.
Hello, thank you, Ambassador, for a wonderful presentation. I have...
Could you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Bonnie Boyd with the Pipeline and the Foreign Policy Association. I wanted to know, in this increasingly multivalent dialogue, where are midstream and downstream producing states, as opposed to always looking at the upstream supplier as the important point of contact for supply? Thank you.
Well, it's difficult to say where it is, but it's there. And, of course, part of the equation. And I really don't know much more to say about that. But it is there. It is being discussed. You cannot have a sensible view of, let's say, the future without taking all these things into consideration.
Very last question from the gentleman right here.
Thank you. Richard Wallace. I'm a U.S.-based energy consumer in my family. is there some spot in your website where one can see the U.S. voluntary contribution over the years as it goes? And secondly, who's the U.S. point of contact for your group in our, to leading to our minister? Thank you.
Well, our contact minister is the Energy Secretary. When the dialogue started, the U.S. was not represented by ministers at these ministerial level conferences, but by senior officials. And I think the first minister who participated was Bill Richardson in 2000, when the meeting was in Riyadh. And since then, the energy ministers have been present. We don't post the voluntary contributions on the website. And this is something that we ask for voluntary contributions, and we receive them from countries. We have received contributions from the U.S.
I hate to close this meeting without giving Steve Galogli a chance to ask a question. Do you have a question you'd like to ask Steve?
Well.
Anyway, well, with that, let me close the meeting, and let me thank Ambassador for his great remarks.
Thank you.